Welcome to The Daily Decrypt, the go-to podcast for all things cybersecurity. Get ready to decrypt the complexities of cyber safety and stay informed. Today is January 26, 2024, the most important day of your life. Here is your host, Offset Keys.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to The Daily Decrypt. Today we have three stories and a little bonus segment. First up, we're going to talk about a vulnerability in Pandas security software. We're going to discuss a Jenkins vulnerability. And finally, we're going to talk about Apple's new protection against stolen iPhones. And then the bonus segment, I just wanted to talk about an article I found pretty interesting, deciphering the ransomware victim's mentality. And so you can look forward to that at the end of today's episode. All right, so the first story we're going to discuss comes by Andreas Klopsch from Sophos, where we're taking a closer look at significant vulnerabilities discovered in a widely used security driver from Panda Security. So Panda Security is renowned in the cybersecurity arena and provides antivirus and cybersecurity solutions primarily to individual consumers and small to medium-sized businesses. Their software, trusted for protecting against malware and cyber threats, is integral to the digital safety of countless users. The driver at the center of this issue is crucial in several of Panda's security products like Panda Dome and WatchGuard EPDR. It performs essential security tasks, making its integrity vital. The discovery of these vulnerabilities thus poses a pretty substantial security concern. So let's go ahead and break down these vulnerabilities. The first one targets non-paged memory, which is a critical section of system memory always kept in physical RAM for immediate access, essential for system stability. All right, so attackers could overflow this memory by inserting malicious data into certain registry values, potentially leading to remote code execution. So bad stuff. All right, so there's another vulnerability which involves out-of-bounds write. Imagine this as writing data outside the designated memory area, okay? It's like trying to write outside the lines of a notebook. Only in this case, it can lead to severe system compromises, including remote code execution. So there's the final vulnerability, 3 out of 3, allows unauthorized access to kernel memory, the core of a computer's operating system, which should be completely off limits to most processes. Panda Security has addressed these vulnerabilities with patches released in January. This swift response helps protect users, but also underlines the critical need for regular software updates. So, you know, if you are a Panda user, please update your software. It should be automatic, hopefully, but if not, please go ahead and update. I've never actually heard of Panda, but it's good they're taking these seriously and pushing out updates and keeping the public informed. So thank you to Sophos for bringing us that first article. So up next, we will be talking about a critical Jenkins vulnerability. The Hacker News delivered this article, which is about a serious vulnerability in Jenkins. Jenkins is a crucial tool in the world of DevOps. It's an open source automation server and plays a key role in software development, particularly in continuous integration and delivery processes. So if you ever see the acronym CICD with a slash in between, it stands for continuous integration, continuous deployment, which is how most interactive software, whether it be internal or external, is deployed and maintained. You make changes to the code on the back end. You don't want it to affect the front end immediately until it's tested and stuff like that. And then when you push it, you want it to not take down the whole software, to take the whole code base into the cloud. You want the code to be continuously integrated and continuously deployed without any downtime. So that's where Jenkins comes into play. So the first vulnerability is found in Jenkins' built-in command line interface. So pretty important. The vulnerability is an arbitrary file read vulnerability, which in technical terms means an attacker could exploit this flaw to read any file on the server. This is akin to having unrestricted access to sensitive information with potential for severe consequences. In extreme cases, this vulnerability could escalate to remote code execution, where attackers gain the ability to run malicious code on the server, effectively taking control as if they were legitimate administrators. So that is exactly what we do not want to happen. Remote code execution might not sound as bad as it is, and it sounds bad already, but that essentially means these savvy attackers can do whatever they want. So We may not be aware of what the attackers are in there trying to get access to, but they are, and if they have remote code execution or RCE, they will get it. So we'd like to protect that. I have a little bit more information on Jenkins for your understanding. It functions much like the conductor of an orchestra. It orchestrates various stages of the software development. So this vulnerability is like a glitch in the system that could throw off the entire developmental harmony. So not only can this vulnerability, you know, take down your whole product, it can stop the continuous integration, continuous deployment of your product. It can also access the crown jewels. So those are like two huge issues, right? Downtime is dollars. You don't want any downtime. This vulnerability could allow attackers to take it down. And it can allow attackers to maybe steal your whole code base, you know, proprietary information. We don't want this. So if you're using Jenkins, which is primarily medium to larger enterprises, make sure you prioritize this patch. It might be tough, but I would say definitely prioritize this. Okay, so that's the first two major breaking news articles. We're going to move into Apple's new defense against iPhone theft, which, as one of your hosts of this podcast, I love mobile security. So if you haven't noticed, most of my episodes touch on something to do with mobile security. So this is mostly for me, but I mean, my whole life is on my phone. If someone got access to my phone, I'd be completely screwed. So I really think it's relevant to most people, and most people don't take it super seriously because the need to take it seriously has increased exponentially every year that a phone has come out. You know, we continually integrate our phones into our lives in more and more ways, and security just isn't keeping up. So Apple's taking it seriously, and in iOS 17.3, which I believe is now available, they've released an additional protection against iPhone theft. So one common attack that's becoming more and more prevalent for everyday users is attackers are in person, you're in a coffee shop per se, and they watch you enter your passcode. So every once in a while, Face ID is like, hey, you got to enter your passcode, my guy. Or you're wearing a mask, or you're wearing glasses and it doesn't recognize you. You had a rough night the night before and you look haggard, and iPhone's like, that's not you. And you're like, aw, which was me this morning because I am in Las Vegas. And iPhone definitely did not recognize me. So the attacker watches you enter this passcode. Most passcodes are numeric only, and they require only 4 digits. And, you know, it's pretty easy to see where a finger is hitting. So the attacker watches you enter it. Then, you know, you get up to go to the bathroom at the coffee shop. They swipe your phone. So if you think about what your passcode can authorize you to do, it's everything on your phone, including, you know, if you've enabled Face ID for logging into your bank or to your Facebook or to all of your contacts. You know, it's just everything. Like, it would be so terrible. So, you know, hopefully you have a passcode on your phone. I recently just changed my passcode to be alphanumeric, so it's harder to what we call eavesdrop and see what I'm typing in. It's a string of letters and numbers. And the keyboard is much smaller. It's harder to get exactly. So if they do steal my iPhone, they have 3 chances to get it right. It's just a password. So I highly recommend doing that, though it does decrease usability. Okay, so that's the backstory. Sorry, I wasn't supposed to go too deep into that, but you know, I'm pretty passionate about it. So the new feature is called Stolen Device Protection, and it makes it harder for thieves to misuse the device in various ways if it's not at a familiar location, like your home or workplace. This is particularly crucial in scenarios where your iPhone is stolen after someone has seen or, quote, shoulder surfed your passcode or forced you to share it. So maybe you're in a, you know, you're in an unsafe environment where someone forces you to share your passcode with them. Then they have your passcode, they run off with your phone. So even though thieves can still access the phone, they won't be able to use passwords or passkeys saved in keychains. So that's a huge thing. You're not allowed to use payment methods in Safari. You're not allowed to disable lost mode. You can't erase all content or settings, or you can't set up a new device using your iPhone. So sometimes when I, you know, spin up a Mac, which is too often these days, it'll ask me to verify on another device. So you can't do that, okay? Nothing in the wallet app either, okay? So if you're like me, you're thinking, hey, I often leave my common locations like my workplace or my home. And so will I be then locked out from using these things? No. Okay, so if you have set up biometrics such as Face ID or Touch ID, which I highly recommend because even if your face or your fingerprint isn't 100% unique, likely attackers aren't going to be able to pass those things. Okay, those are strictly you. So if you have those on, you can use those to pass the barriers. Okay, if you don't, you have to wait an hour. So you can't enter, you can't use your passcode for one whole hour. So that's a bummer. It'll probably decrease the usability of iPhones. But the good and bad news is that this is not enabled by default. So if you're a security buff like me, once your iPhone updates, go enable that. Maybe practice with it a little bit. It's going to change the way you use your iPhone out in public, but it will help keep you safe, you know. So in order to enable it, you need two-factor authentication enabled for your Apple ID, and you need a passcode. You need Face ID or Touch ID. You need the Find My service and significant locations enabled on your iPhone. So please leave a comment below. Let me know what you think about this feature. I can imagine it to be pretty controversial, but I'm pretty excited that they take this seriously. It's a hard problem to solve as a company. Like, what do we do if the devices we sell to our users get stolen? Like, most companies say, not our problem, you know, but I'm pretty proud of Apple for saying, yeah, we're going to figure out a solution to this problem that technically we don't have to figure out a solution for. So if anyone has any contacts at Apple, like, we'd love to be sponsored by them because I keep talking about how great Apple is. So thank you, Apple. Ransomware is the top attack because of how easy it is and how much money they can get out of them. You know, like, I think one of our previous segments talked about how many millions, even billions of dollars was stolen last year. And if you think about that dollar amount being stolen, you know, like, even the most significant bank heists of all time did not even get in the millions, I think. You know, it's like such a low number per bank heist, and the risk is so high, like death. So now we have this vessel for attackers to get way more money and be in a foreign country, you know, without an extradition treaty, and are pretty much unfindable. So we're going to venture into an absorbing topic highlighted by James Reddick from The Record, which focuses on a study by Tom Muirs, who is a cybercrime researcher from the University of Twente, which I believe is Dutch. So Muirs' research, scrutinizing 382 ransomware attacks reported to Dutch police along with additional data from an incident responder, uncovers some compelling patterns. A standout finding is that companies engaging third-party incident response firms are more inclined to pay the ransoms. Interesting. An interesting twist here is the role of insurance. While it doesn't always influence the decision to pay, it seems to correlate with the higher ransom amounts being paid. This raises thoughts about moral hazard, where insurance coverage might inadvertently encourage more substantial ransom payments. The role of data backups in these scenarios is also revealing. Companies with backups tend not to pay ransoms, but those with backups that do often end up paying more, likely due to the higher value and demand for their data. That's pretty interesting. So data exfiltration, where attackers steal data, not just encrypt it, is another critical factor. It significantly ups the ante, often leading to higher ransom demands as companies face the dual threat of data loss and public exposure. Particularly interesting is the situation of IT companies. Despite often having robust data backups, they make attractive targets for ransom actors due to their essential services affecting multiple clients. So this is like what we consider MSP or managed service providers, where companies provide IT services to multiple subsidiary companies. You know, so if you're a smaller company, you can't afford your own IT department, you outsource it to them. So essentially, if this company gets ransomware, they have access to a pool of other companies' data, which makes it much more valuable. So yeah, this study from Muirs offers more than just numbers. It presents a nuanced view of the ransomware landscape, shedding light on the various factors influencing how and why ransom payments are made. So the URL to this article will be in the show notes, along with the URLs to all the other articles we talked about. I recommend, just if you're curious about the topic, maybe take a glance at that article. Definitely take a glance at the Apple security feature article, and enable those features. And we really appreciate you listening to the Daily Decrypt. If you like it, or even kind of like it, or have enjoyed getting your news this way, please just open up Spotify and click the 5-star review. It really helps, and super easy. You don't have to write anything. But if you happen to not give us 5 stars and lower than that, which is very valuable feedback to us, we really appreciate any feedback, even if it's 1-star feedback. We just ask that you drop a comment or somehow communicate with us what you didn't like or what you'd like to see that can get it up to a 5-star review. We wanna make sure that you guys are getting your news the way you want to get your news. So yeah, we really appreciate you listening. That's it for this week. Tomorrow, we'll have a little bonus episode that was pre-recorded on the Link Local Multicast Name Resolution Protocol and how it's vulnerable to hijacking attacks. So it's pretty interesting. It's still a really common vulnerability that's exploited quite often. It's hard to detect. And so if you're a little iffy on your understanding of how that works, please go ahead and download the episode, listen on your drive in. And yeah, that's it. I'm Offset Keys, and you've been listening to the Daily Decrypt. Thanks.